Roll call, we have everybody here tonight. And we will start with 2.01, DOT presentation, SR 26, and first, Bob. And Bob has Kirk Berg, Assistant Regional Administrator, correct? Did I get that right?
Yes.
With him also. Go ahead, Bob, it's all yours.
Thanks for having me back. We'll go quickly through the, I'll bring the aerial back up and we can talk off of that. I did manage to get some traffic projections and we'll cover those tonight as well. There we go, that's better. Okay, I'll be real brief again and go over the project one more time for anybody that hasn't seen us before or been part of this workshop. Essentially where we're at is history is we did stage one a couple years back where we regraded underneath the bridge on Highway 24 that goes to Broadway. We improved the vertical clearance, which was stage one, was to get the trucks. To get the trucks underneath instead of up to the intersection. History of this intersection is, of course, all the accidents that occur right here. It's the cross movement and the turning movements where we're getting a lot of the accidents that we've seen over the years. So this project here is to reduce those by essentially restricting some of the movements. What we have here is we still provide left turn movement going on to First Street, but we eliminate the cross traffic going between First Avenue and the spur, and we also eliminate the left turn movement onto the spur off for the westbound on 26, which what we do then is effectively we're directing more traffic. Say if you want to, excuse me, if you're heading westbound, you're going to be taking a right on First and up to Columbia, which is about here and over and then down. That's one of the major changes in the traffic pattern. The other one, of course, is traffic heading southbound on First, now they're not going to be able to take a left and go eastbound. All the accesses on this proposal are still intact. It's just the traffic patterns are changing. So we have raised islands to eliminate or to inhibit people that are going to try to shoot across or make it an illegal or a different turn than we're trying to accomplish here on this. So anyway, what we have is we're restricting the movements here. We're proposing to do some rechannelization. If we can scroll up just a little bit to Columbia Street. Okay. Rechannelize this. So we're a couple things here. This is a real tricky little corner right here. We have this potato shed. We've talked to the business owner, so it looks viable to come in here and do a little retrofit, clip this corner out and rebuild part of this building and improve this radius for the truck turning movements. All these corners here are proposed to be improved for the turning movements of WB50 trucks or the typical haul truck that you see, not necessarily the big interstate trucks, but those still can be negotiated through here as well. So the idea is to get the movement on Columbia Street to make this whole thing work out. And that's where we're looking at right now, and that's where our proposal is as it stands. That's where we left off back in August. There's some history on this project. This project's been going on since 2005. A little history, as I denoted in the letter to the city, is the VE study. This project was endorsed as basically what we're showing. Stage one was funded based off of what was endorsed by the city back in the a few years back, and we're back to finish stage two. And then after the last city council and input from the local businesses, we have a little different flavor that seemed to have come into the picture, and that's where we're at now. What I said the last meeting was that I try to get some traffic projections to kind of illustrate what the impacts could be or not be. They did come in. I got them last Friday afternoon. I sent them down to Eamon this afternoon, so he has a set, and what I want to work through is kind of walk you through that. But before I go to that, does anybody have any questions before I walk away from this slide right here? Any questions on the turning movements? Okay. Okay, what we're showing here is the existing configuration. That's what's out there right now, 2013, 2 years out. The numbers I want you folks to key in on is what we're looking at here is these little numbers in the parentheses. These are design hourly vehicles, the turning movements of the vehicles that are making these turns, that will be making these turns if nothing changes right now. And these are what we project out, 45 vehicles an hour, making a turn, coming, making, like, say, for instance, this number here is indicating that you got a northbound traffic on First Avenue, and they're going to make a left onto Columbia. You're looking at about 45 hourly. And that's a simple explanation. What I want to kind of lay out here is what's going on when we do a reconfiguration versus the existing configuration. So right now, these are the numbers, and I apologize. I wish I had them side by side so you could make a comparison, but I want to key in on a couple intersections that are affecting the businesses on this. And this intersection is one of them right here on Columbia and First Street, and the next one south on Highway 26. There we go. This one right here, this is Highway 26. And these again are our turning movements. Like for instance, left turn, turning up to First Street, you got 180 design hourly vehicles making that turn. Likewise, if they're taking a right turn onto 26 and heading westbound, you got 150 vehicles. These are the numbers that and I apologize, I really wish I had them side by side because it'd be a lot easier to explain this instead of flashing back and forth. So. What I'm looking at here is this is the existing. Now, if we can scroll down to the next slide down on the tabs on the bottom, go to 2013 proposed. Next one over. There we go. No, go back. 13, that one. There we go. Okay, if we scroll down, starting off at Columbia, and what I have here is the numbers, if you have proposed and what's existing. For instance, on the going to Columbia and you want to take a right and head south on First Avenue, the key thing is because we're redirecting traffic here, what's happening is it's changing the patterns, and you're going to start seeing some numbers increase because of the pattern changes, primarily at this intersection. You're going to see a lot more turning movements coming in and out of this intersection off of Broadway, coming down. So you're going to see increased traffic, increased turning movements, increased vehicles because we're restricting movements. You're losing some of the access to the spur, which forces more traffic into the city limits. So that's what we have here. You're going to see an increase. Like I denoted on the last slide, for instance, that left turn, if you're heading north and on Columbia, it had 45. What we have here now is 90. It's doubled. These are the projections that we're seeing. And that's just to illustrate a point on the traffic. This is in 2013. If we can scroll down to 26 and First, right here, stop. Okay, very good. This number here, 145, you're going to take a right turn heading up north for the westbound traffic on 26. This is for with the proposed change. What the existing shows is 50. because what we're doing again is we're eliminating left turn coming down the spur and going down to head south on 24. Now the traffic will be required to take a right and go up First. You're going to see an increase in traffic going up First Street because of these proposed changes. If we walk over to, say, this corner here, you have 180 for proposed in 2013. What I have here is this doesn't change for the existing configuration. What I have here for this right, this right turn going westbound on 26, this is 190 designed hourly. What it has with existing is 150. The reason why it increased is because now this right turn, this left turn off the spur has been basically taken away. Traffic now is going to have to come out and around Columbia Street and down and then take a right to get on 26. Basically what the projections show on the 2013 and the 2033 pretty much shows increased traffic going along First Street through there because of the reconfiguration and the restriction. Primarily it's all driven by because we're restricting the access onto the spur. And that's why you're seeing an increase in traffic. Well, we left off the last open house back in August, there was concerns that that was going to drop off because of this restrictions. And these projections are what are showing me is that actually, no, it's going to go the other way around. You're going to see increased traffic. We haven't changed any accesses on First Street. We haven't changed any accesses on Columbia. So the concern was the business community that I heard loud and clear the last time I was here. What I told you is I was going to get some traffic projections. The police chief noticed the counters. We had counters out, and they ran the counter numbers, and this is what they came up with. So at that point, I'd like to leave it out there and try to answer some questions on the traffic projections.
Any questions from the citizens, business people?
I'm going to have a bad answer for you on that one. I apologize. I'm not the traffic expert in as far as how they did the projections. Basically, what the folks over in headquarters came, ran numbers, looked at the configurations based off the counts that they had. When you start cutting off movement, the traffic has to go somewhere, and that's how they projected it. And that's a very simple answer, and I apologize, but that's what I'm going to give you on that.
Any other? Joe?
And I wrote a letter to your director for the region, and I'm sure you'll see it. I am concerned because as in many towns in the district that have a main road that goes through, where you have to turn off to get to the businesses there. I think you're putting those businesses in harm's way. I think because you make it that much harder to turn to go around, because basically we're talking about convenience stopping. They're not going to stop. I can pretty much guarantee that. Because I know exactly what you're saying here, and how the traffic flow is going to go around. And that I think you're putting those businesses in harm's way. I think if you value their property by following through with this, because less people are going to stop. And so, in essence, you're taking part of the value of that property from what it is now, where they have open access and good access, where it's easy to stop. Hindrances like this, and I understand what you're thinking, that it's been a dangerous intersection. But for the sake of those businesses, anytime there's a hindrance, it makes it harder to pull into, to get in and then to get back out on the road. They won't stop. They will just go right on through. And it's not just in this community, it's a lot of, especially the smaller towns. That is a real challenge. How do you get people to stop? And when you make it harder, and this will make it harder to access those businesses that are located along the road, and they located there for a reason, they won't stop. They'll they'll just keep going. They'll stop in Ellensburg and then make it the rest of the way. I just don't believe that, this will hinder. I firmly believe that.
We certainly concur. We're in the convenience business. We believe we lose convenience, we lose sales. We are losing. I guess we've chatted about this before. I don't feel we lose before either. I certainly believe some numbers patterns will change just by the nature of these. But I'm putting myself as a traveler, and I think I would drive by if it was any meaning for me to get in there.
Absolutely, I understand that. That was the message that you guys gave me loud and clear back in August. And I haven't forgotten.
Yeah, go ahead, Representative Joe Schmidt.
I just one other point I'd like to make. The fact is that when the economy the way it is, that we do to hinder business and commerce, I think has to be looked through that light. We're going to sit here another 2-3 years and go from some other economy. And you're going to hurt these businesses like this. I'm sorry. I think you're barking up the wrong tree.
You know, and I'll go ahead. Susan wants to.
Okay. Yeah, Representative Susan Fagan, you want to go ahead and say something?
Well, I was just going to ask, you were talking about the projections that were done by some of the Washout staff in Olympia.
Olympia, right.
So did they do any projections on what if you reduced the speed limit? I travel this road a lot, so.
Totally independent of speed.
Excuse me?
It's independent of speed on the projections. Speed has nothing to do with the how much traffic is going to travel the highway. That's not a factor when they do a projection.
So you would look at speed to see if you could reduce accidents?
No, I didn't say that. You asked about projections. Reducing speed changes the type of accidents because, apologize, the city got the memo that I sent. Apparently didn't get attached the first time around. What happens? What happens when they define the speed limits? It's based off of the 85 percentile. Basically, the theory on that is that the folks will drive at the reasonably safe speed. That's the 85% of the people will do that. That's how we establish our speeds on this highway, or any state highway for that matter. That's policy. What happens is when you try to reduce speed, it violates driver expectation. There's still 85% are going to try to drive safe, but what happens is it does, I should take to step back, what happens is they increase the risk that most people will not drive at the posted speed. They'll drive at what they perceive as the safe speed, not necessarily what's posted out there. And so what you have is you have more conflict with the law enforcement officers because then they have to enforce it, and you have more people that are going to violate it because it violates their driver's how they expect to drive on a highway. The visual cues, everything that goes along with that when you drive it, you're going to drive what you feel is safe. But when you put a speed that's too slow out there, people have a hard time following that. They really do. So basically what you're doing is you're setting it up for another accident to occur. Actually, accidents can increase with reducing speed. There is that potential.
So you have scientific data that shows that this configuration is far superior to trying to reduce the speed. I agree with my colleague that this is a important time to be impacting our local businesses, and we're all interested in safety.
Right. I don't have any data for economic impacts.
So you would make a decision like this without?
This project has been going on since before 2005. It was endorsed by the city, recognizing that there is some impacts because of the change in traffic patterns. We haven't just showed up and started doing this job. It's been going on for quite a while. It was endorsed by the city. City was involved with what we call the VE process, the value engineering process. We explored many options of how to reduce the accidents at this intersection. What this is, and which was endorsed by the city, was a way to eliminate some turning movements and cross patterns that were causing the accidents. This is what this project is all about. You know, 4 years ago, I don't think we'd be having this discussion right now. Timing is bad right now because of the economy. I won't deny that. But here we are. We've had an endorsed project. We're trying to finish stage two, and the timing isn't the best for the community. But the safety issue still is there. So what do we do about it?
Mm-hmm. And you know, like has been stated many times, that any hindrance whatsoever in today's economy is a real problem, because we're in a situation that your performance structure of your business is such that it's on the weekend, so we have very little room of buffer. Any little changes can push you over the edge, and certainly that's a concern. And I understand the mandate and the issues for safety, but perhaps a more economical means, and not willing to take the targets relative to the projections as face value, perhaps maybe a softer approach at this particular time would make more sense within the economy.
Sean Logan, or yeah, Logan. You want to answer that, Amy?
Back in 05, and it's been almost 7 years ago that the value engineering study was done. Our public works director at the time was involved. It was a week-long study that was conducted in Wenatchee relative to the intersection at 26 and First Avenue. The study lasted a week, as I said. I went up for the last day, and At that point, the discussion was, because of the number of accidents and the safety factor, that First Avenue was being considered to be blocked off. So then we talked about, well, let's just put an island. What's the problem? The problem is the crossing traffic. So let's just put an island out there and deal with the crossing traffic. So that's where it ended, relative to what we had thought and designed at the time. With the caveat, and we talked about this several times, even at council, that there would be three public hearings with the business owners and the city council to talk about the final design and what the desires of the community are. And that's where we are today.
How many hearings have been held?
I'm sorry?
How many public hearings have been held so far?
I think we've had two. But we've had lots of public meetings. And we've invited, by letter and phone call, all the owners of businesses that are impacted by the intersection.
And I believe it wasn't until this year till we finally seen a drawing of what that intersection would actually look like.
The value engineering study that Eamon referred to had that in there. And actually, one of the concepts is that we had barrier running up the center line of 26, precluding any turnment, any of the movement for the eastbound traffic to even make a left. You know, one of the, through the design process, we backed away with a caveat. We backed away and provided, put that left turn for the eastbound traffic to go up First Street. With the caveat is if we monitor the intersection, monitor the accidents, if they started rising, then we'd have to be, come back and revisit what we were planning on doing there. That is the big change from the, what happened in the VE study. We actually made it a little less invasive from what we initially was endorsed. And that's why we're here today. Is that's, you know, trying to minimize those accidents. There's no magic bullet on this thing. You know, it's the turning movements and the cross traffic that are causing the accidents. Traffic's only going to increase. So along with that, so will the accidents.
Okay, what I've seen here is, you know, and I don't see a great impact on westbound traffic because they're going to get the right on and get the right off. But it greatly affects the eastbound traffic because mm-hmm. they're going to get to turn off left, and we're not eliminating that left-hand turn. We still got people, you're not eliminating that left-hand turn. But once that person gets off, it's going to be confusing, even with signage, for them to pull back around. I kind of took a look at this using my own driving habits. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we're creatures of, we get in a habit of going somewhere. When I go somewhere with my wife, she hates it because I'll get on Google, I'll have it Googled out, I'll have exactly the where I'm going, and I'm in a hurry to get to where I'm going, and I'll enjoy it. And I don't like any hindrance when I turn off, because I've got my route planned. And this will cause a lot of hindrance, I believe, for that eastbound traffic. Because once they start, once you get them off the first time, and they realize the inconvenience to get back on, they're not going to stop a second time. I believe they'll just drive on through. And your numbers showed that that would actually increase. Mm-hmm. I think it will decrease. A person will do it the first time, but they won't do it the second time.
It's so easy to pull right off the road, off of Highway 26, right up the road here in Royal City. They can pull right off and right back on, just like it is here. And that's where they're going to stop.
I kind of see with Kim, you know, the more you stop, the longer it takes. I'm going to a football game or a basketball game or a track meet, or I'm taking my kid to WSU, and I leave Seattle, think I got plenty of time, and I get up on the pass, and I get screwed up there, and then the traffic's heavy, so I can't go 60 miles an hour, so I'm late. So I pull up to Othello down here, and all of a sudden, I can't pull in and get something to eat, and that, you know, I mean, it's 170 miles, that's a pretty nice stop. And it, but I can't, so I have to pull off the highway, go two blocks, go block south, go block west, stop at a stop sign, go two blocks north, turn left, go a block to the west, stop at a stop sign, and there's probably a couple of trucks coming through there, I have to wait for them, and then I pull down to where I want to stop and eat, then I gotta go back around there again, and you can't stop at a rest stop like Indian John, and get out of your car, walk into the rest stop, and come back out. By the time you slow down, pull in, go to the restroom, start back up, it's going to take you 10 minutes. And I think any trucker will tell you that if he can pull 55 miles an hour on the road for 5 hours, he'll beat you to town if you're driving 65. And so here you're pulling in here, it's going to take you 20 minutes to get off the highway, back around here to the thing, and back around and get back on the highway and get started back up to 60 miles an hour. That's just all there is to it. It's going to cost you that much time. That's my feeling about it. And the next time I come through, I'm gone. I'm not going to stop you. These guys down here are going to suffer. That's the way it is. And another question, I guess, that comes up. The major intersections up here on 14th. That's become busy. There's going to be another school there, and I'll bet you dollars to donuts somebody's going to buy that corner and they're going to put in a rest stop there, a gas station up there, then what are you going to do? You got the same problem there you got down here. So, you know, I'm not sure that running everybody around is going to make that much difference. I don't understand why a speed limit of, say, 40 miles an hour through there, and I'll sign up there that says this is your speed, and put a fake camera up there so they look like they're getting a picture taken, would be that disruptive to traffic through the highway, and it still would free us up to get the traffic back into town. That's what I'm seeing.
I also have one concern myself. When you turn south off of 17 or 26 to go south right there, you have a list of 150 cars an hour, is what you're thinking? Is that what you're saying?
You're saying this turn limit here?
Yes.
Right turn? That's what the projections, this is 2013, right?
I work at Evergreen Implement, which is right, the John Deere dealership right,
right
there. It already backs up almost to the intersection fairly regularly right now. there's going to be some type of plans for them to get off of there, get out that intersection right there. I don't know what you're going to do there, but...
This intersection?
Yeah. That you know, we right talked there. About that. There's a little bit of a problem with vision there.
On the sight distance?
Yes.
Yeah, we're looking at trying to improve this. Apologize for the, but I'll just use this diagram. It's a tight radius right through here as you're heading northbound on 24 and turning onto the spur. And what that's doing is it's also impacting how traffic heading southbound is making a turn onto here. So it has a tendency that we have our stop bar a little further back for the turning movements of the truck to get on there. That's one of the problems going on. What we're looking at trying to do is improve this radius a little bit so we can move, so when trucks turning southbound can make a turn to get on, which means then we can move this stop bar up a little further, closer to the 24 to get better sight distance. We're looking at seeing how we can make that happen on this project. It's really difficult with this bridge here and how it's set up. It's just not a lot of room in there to get the sight distance you really need, but we're trying to find a way to get there, and the way we can get there and improve it a little bit is to improve this radius right through here to provide for trucks to make that turn, and then we can get the stop bar moved up a little bit. So we're looking at that. But we recognize there is a sight distance issue there, and we're trying to improve it the best we can with what we have out there. Not a lot of room.
Representative Fagan?
I was just going to ask two things. One, are you bound by all recommendations that previous councils have endorsed? And then two, did the previous council in 2005 or whatever date they endorsed this, did they have all of this information that you're presenting tonight?
The traffic projections I got last Friday. But everything else, all the options, the channelization's been tweaked a little bit to minimize impact to accesses. We did some fine tuning, which was less invasive than what the original value engineering endorsed concept was. So we've actually softened it since the VE study. Apparently not enough, but we have softened it. And recognizing the whole thing that I'm hearing here is that any inconvenience to the traveling public as far as these businesses go, and you're gonna see a drop in the business.
So you're telling me the previous council had all of this information and knew about all of this?
I'm thinking so. Eamon, I don't want to speak for you on that one.
So
if I can there.
That's a good idea, Dan.
Go ahead, Eamon.
Yep.
Economy's
changed. Nobody saw the economy going down like it did. It wasn't so much an issue as it is the last couple months on this project. So I don't want to speak for the city council on where their thoughts were, so I'll have to defer that to him or the council.
I can't speak for the council either, but I can share the history of what happened. And again, the previous council did see most of this at the time. However, there was a caveat that said subject to citizen input and community input. So it was always subject to a forum like this where the council and the public got to speak and share information with DOT. Mm-hmm. And they've said many times, this is not cast in stone. Mm-hmm. We want to hear from the public and the council.
Right. So based off the concepts that we're proposing for the channelization, the city went after a grant and got a grant to do the improvements. And that's where we are today. This grant money came through the state to finance improvements that we're talking about now at the intersection of 26th and First Avenue. Also, the improvements at Columbia, we looked at Waluke Street, side note, but Columbia is the preferred arterial to tie into Broadway. And that's what the funding was based off of, that concept, to reduce the amount of accidents that we're having at this intersection.
Just a second, Ken. Make sure when you're speaking, you speak loud and say your name, please, and who you're with, so that we can get it typed onto the records here. Go ahead.
Ross Hogan with One Action Petroleum. I guess I've kind of got a question. On your spur route here, for the people that are going to be turning and heading east on the highway, okay, what are you going to have on there for the on-ramp? I mean, or is it going to be yield, or how are they going to get onto the highway? Because, I mean, here's a little scenario for you. 7, 8 o'clock on a nice summer evening, the sun is setting, you got the sun in your eyes and your mirrors on a big truck, guy hauling potatoes or what have you, got a car, passenger car coming with mom, dad, and the kids heading wherever. Mr. Truck Driver doesn't see him, he starts merging, they swerve into oncoming traffic. It seems to me that by doing it this way and having this and drawing more traffic down that spur road to get back on the highway is increasing the amount of accidents you're going to have for that time of night.
Accidents right here or down
That's
here?
That's correct. By drawing more people on that spur road and trying to go back east mm-hmm. on the highway, it seems to me that by drawing all those extra people down there, you're going to add more people trying to get on to an already busy highway. And at that time of the night, somebody not see them coming because the sun's in their mirrors. I mean, you're putting the people who are traveling east on 26 at risk. And I know me, if I see a truck swerving over, moving over, and not slowing down, I'm swerving or hitting the brakes. So you're looking at head-on collisions or rear ends. I mean, has that been bought into this whole process of trying to make things safer?
I think we've pretty much overturned every stone possible. The key thing here, I understand what you're saying, increased turning here is what you're concerned about with, say, the eastbound traffic is what I'm hearing, right? Yeah, I think, and the other issue, you're right, the other issue is we had cross traffic, people trying to run it across. Here you have a more controlled environment here where they stop, and then they wait, and they look, and they yield, and they pull out. You can see here we're also improving the turning onto the highway as well to give them that extra room so they get onto the highway.
Mm-hmm. Bob, are you expanding that on-ramp wider or anything of that nature?
This?
Yes, right there.
We're improving the radius and the taper onto the highway.
How many, are you extending further out? I mean,
this way?
You're improving the radius, but as you head east, is that being lengthened for an on-ramp type of structure?
You mean like an acceleration lane?
Correct.
Right now it's a taper.
Eugene?
Eugene Banks. That you're pointing out right there, has it been talked about or thought as far as closing that side of the intersection off and running that lane farther down? There's nothing but open land there. I don't know whose it is. I don't know what, but bringing it down farther and putting the out?
Yeah, we talked about a lot of things on the value engineering study. It all comes down to dollars. This here is for the money available, is the best fix that we could come up with. If you're talking about anything more, you're talking more millions. There's no millions out there to grab. I know. Highway construction is not cheap. You got to buy right away. You have impacts to businesses that people are concerned about, and it's just really not in the cards right now, funding wise. We did do a value engineering study, and the best case solution, which has impacts to the businesses, to put interchange in there. But then we're buying out all the businesses along the highway right there. But ultimately down the road, people build around interchanges. So that, you know, initially there's a hurt when you put the interchange in, but as you build an interchange, people come and businesses come. Interchange, you're talking $36 million. I know, I understand that, but even a even adding a frontage road, you're talking a couple million by the time you buy a right of way and build a new road. Yeah, we looked at those things. Look at this as an interim. This is an interim fix to the problem, the accidents that we're seeing right now. Long-term fix would be an interchange. But right now, with the funding and where we're at, this is the best bang for the buck that we could come up with.
Okay.
Well, I've been hearing a lot of things. I've been looking at a lot of things. You set out there the intersection, number one, and see that traffic out there. And I guess I get a different look than what Warsidot does. First, I want to bring up a little history. You're talking about 2005. Here's something that just happened to come out of the Othello Outlook last week from our pages of Time. September 29th, or September 25th, 1991. In this, they say we're going to have caution lights on Highway 26, and we're going to have stoplights on North and South on First Street. And it says it's in the plans, and it'll be erected shortly. Well, where is it? It's 20 years, and I haven't seen them yet. I don't know. I've got some ideas here that I think should be done, and I think Warsidot should look and see what's going on in the rest of the state. They have built a lot of highways, they've changed a lot of highways. And I don't quite understand their reasoning. They can read all this paperwork here, and it says that speed limit, we can't slow it down. That's ridiculous. Go to Wenatchee. Highway 28. At one time they say you can't have stoplights. Well, there's several of them there. There's reduced speed. Go to Quincy, Highway 28. You slow down, you're going right through town. Go to Ephrata, you slow down, you've got stoplights right through town. They're still on the state highway. This Highway 26 is the same thing. We're going through the city of Othello. Slow down. After all, this is our livelihood. This is people at stake who's going to get hurt and killed. I don't care what you say about, oh, this is going to change this, this is going to help that. But here's a few facts. If you would take, slow that speed down to 35 miles an hour, and put in some flashing lights and show your speed, it would tell you that you're going too damn fast. You got a 50 mile an hour speed limit out there now. And you look at trucks and things and they're doing 60 or better. They don't slow down. If you put a stop sign out there, they won't probably blow right on through it. And if you put a stop light out there, sure. Well, we can't have one because we don't have one 40 miles either direction. And that's what I've been hearing. Don't have one in Vantage. You don't have one in, whatever, I mean, that's where 26 actually starts. You don't have one until you get to Colfax. But you go through Colfax, you have stoplights, but they're in town. But it's on a state highway. This thing here is just one phase of this. Like you say, Highway 26 is this one intersection. 14th Street is going to be the next one. Cunningham out here is the same way. And someday you got to put some stoplights in there and get people to slow down or stop. And there's no sense cutting off the traffic and say, okay, you can't go left, you can't go right, I can't do this, I can't do that. Right now, if you would stop the trucks from making left turns on 26, you would stop a lot of these accidents that happen. Because what they're doing, if they're going eastbound on 26, they're stopped to wait for the traffic. What they do, your little short storage area that you have for your left turn lanes, pretty soon the cars are backing up and they're over in the through traffic lane. So it creates a hazard, creates a problem. Same way the other direction. All of a sudden you can't turn this way, you can't turn left going south. Well, sure, I can't see, but there's one pops over the hill. But at 35 mile an hour, he's not going to pop over the hill that fast. And I think that's number one thing that should be done, and I think the traffic light ought to be in there. Like you say, you go up to Moses Lake, go through Highway 17, you've got 9 traffic signals, and that's on a state highway. Why can't we have one? It's just ridiculous. If you take and block off what you're trying to do right now, and all of a sudden the left traffic can't go left or the others can't come back out to go on east, your cars will start stopping more and more on the highway. People will be walking across to go get their hamburger or whatever. They do it now because it's too difficult to make that turn and get back out of there. But what will happen is your students, your kids, your parents and whatnot, as they go east, they'll pull off the side of the road or run across the road and get their hamburger. You're going to kill some more kids. If that's what you want to do, that's exactly what you've got set up to do there. I think you need to look at this and go back and talk to your experts and redesign this whole thing. And as far as an endorsement, as far as I know, the only endorsement we had was to do Highway 24 and do that improvement. And then we wanted the final plan on Highway on 26 and First Street. And I don't think we ever got that, and we're still working on it technically. So I don't know where this endorsement totally is coming from. That's my speech for today. Sorry, people.
I guess also just, you talk about the 35 and how it doesn't work very well, miles per hour. I'd be willing to bet probably 80% of the people going to those intersections live here locally. And once they've gone through it once, they know what the speed limit is, you know what I mean, as a whole, as a general. You have other people coming through at times where it goes up and it's 50% because of the volume of kids going back and forth from college. But, and once they go through there once or twice, they know what the speed limit is. You know, it takes time. I don't know if we get enforcement some in that area too for a while so people understand, but that might be a thought too, some enforcement by the State Patrol. Is that who does that? You know, and I'm just like, Ken, I'd like to see the 35 mile an hour thing tried long before we try this and see if it works. But
Bob, what kind of dollar amount are we talking about on this second phase?
It's running around $600,000. Right. We don't have quite that funding right now to do that, and we're looking for additional.
You know,
that's what I told you the last meeting I was at here.
And we've been sitting here looking, this community's looking at is it is going to be an economic impact to this community. The governor has just called back special legislation in November and is looking at another 10% reduction in the budget. You know, I think the state would be looking at different ways to help cut back on their budget too. And I'm really in support of reducing the speed limit, which would be much less costly at this moment. They were saying 35, I support a 40, but 35 would be nice. You know, starting back about before Moon Road, because there has been a few accidents at the Moon Road, because that's just where it starts coming up over the hill on the eastbound traffic. And all the way back to 14th, because we know 14th is going to be a potential problem, you know. I would really love to see the speed limit put on there with some additional signing, which would save the state a lot of money at this point, and take a look at it for several years, couple years, and see what the reduced speed limit, a study on that, what it actually does. You know, if it don't change anything and we're still seeing all the accidents, this might be the solution. But like I say, in these times, I think the least amount that we could spend and still try to protect the people going through that intersection would be a good idea.
Charles, did you have something you wanted to say?
Hi, Bob. I wasn't here 5 years ago, and I'm very thankful for that, by the way. But the reality is, and I speak from a lot of experience, because I don't think anybody in this room has ever traveled those roads more than I have. Born and raised here, grew up on the other side of those tracks, know that highway, know that access to 24, have seen you reroute it, have seen it been a nightmare, because underneath it's nice and Don't trucks get stuck and all that good stuff. But the reality is, that's a nightmare. You add more agricultural movement in there, and you're going to have a lot more accidents. It's just the way it is. You implement the plan that you want to right now, and I've lived here all my life, I wouldn't even stop up there. I'd travel bench and get away from you, because there's no way I could go in and out from where I live. And that's just me, and I'm just using that as an example. But we keep reverting back to this grant, you know, and I understand the business standpoint from it, because these people, they're watching us jump over a dollar to save a penny. And I'm not saying our life is a penny, but from a business standpoint, that's what it is. And actually, the city is, for the most part, run like a business. And we will lose that almighty dollar just like they will, if they're not generating the revenue and we're not receiving sales tax and what have you. So, as my dad has always told me, sometimes no deal is a good deal. And this might be that. I mean, I think the easy fix, and I support most of my council members here, is to put up either a light or put up the added speed limit signs and a little more patrolling and what have you. Maybe, you know, old stick throw a little more accountable. They have to work a little harder. You know, that's just the way life is. I mean, we all have to work a little harder. That's the way the economy is. But we can't kill those businesses. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to kill those businesses every day of the week.
Kirk, Berg, go ahead.
Yeah, I was sitting here listening, and there's been a lot of discussion going around about different things in the businesses. And we respect the opinions of the council. We as DOT also have a job to do. And part of that job is to identify areas where we have high accident locations, identify the type of accidents that are occurring, and take a look at opportunities to reduce the number and severity of those accidents. And this is one of those locations. It's not all that dissimilar, yeah, I'm going to say dissimilar, than just a couple miles down the road. Highway 26 and Highway 17 intersection used to be a two-way stop. Flashing lights have been an issue for a long, long, long time. And flashing lights, oversized stop signs, rumble strips, just a whole bunch of interim safety, low-cost enhancements were tried, and it took an interchange to change that, because the accidents and the severe accidents were still occurring. And slowing people down was not happening. And here, we've seen, as a department and the state and our specialists in traffic, saying just putting up a reduced speed sign is not effective and does not improve the situation. So at this location, that's not going to happen. From the Department of Transportation standpoint, we're not going to walk away and do nothing but lower the speed limit. I think Bob's made that.
So why are we here? What's that? I said, so why are we even having this meeting? If you're telling us that's not even an option, then why do we have meetings to talk about this?
Okay, that's I'm heading in that direction.
Okay.
We've worked with the city, Bob asked for some time. This project isn't anything new. Money in one way or another, our interest is to take some sort of action, whatever that action needs to be, in order to reduce the accidents and the types of collisions at this intersection. We're really looking for the city of 1,000 endorsement as we move forward other than those. It'd be really nice to have some facts on loss of business. It's all conjecture.
See a bankrupt before we do something?
I'd like to see some basis, because from we've got that responsibility to protect the citizens and reduce accidents on the state highway system. That's part of what we do, and that's not only part of our responsibility, I think that's part of everybody's responsibility in this room. So I guess we can go around and around and around. At this point in time, I'm not sure how to get the response out of the city council. Maybe I guess a recommendation that I would have is to actually set up, put an item on the next city council's agenda for a hearing and request an endorsement or not from the city. That'll make it official, since this was a workshop.
We appreciate the traveling east, and you could put a lane, turn lane, and that was nice, the left-hand turns that get into the businesses. But, you know, like all of rural America, there's a struggle to stay alive in rural America. And that's our big issue here, is that we want to stay alive. We want these communities, businesses down through there to have very minimal impact. And that's our real concern. I mean, we'll put it on the next agenda, but I'm not going to say how it's going to turn out. But, you know, we can put it on the next agenda, so. But, you know, as you can tell, we all have a lot of concerns with protecting our businesses. That's part of our tax base in this community, and we have people making livings there that have homes and jobs and families to take care of, and, you know, we worry about that as a community. And as you all know, you've heard tonight, we all know this very well, that the economy isn't rosy, you know, for everybody, so. But we will put it on the next agenda, and we'll see what council wants to do. I guess we'll let it. Does anybody else have a comment on the council before we bring this topic to an end?
I think we've
covered it pretty well, but go ahead.
I still think you're just going to have a bigger problem down there off the spur and Broadway. I travel that every day, and yes. This evening when I came home, trucks were backed up all the way to the highway. There's trucks backed up trying to turn onto the spur, and if they block that off and people are going to have to come that way, that's just going to make it worse. You also have Moon Street that people are trying to turn on, so you also got trucks trying to turn there, which can't turn because of the traffic coming this way. So it's just, you know, it'll just move it from there over to there, people getting impatient. There's already people cutting through Evergreen's parking lot because the traffic's backed up there, so they can see the parking lot and then come down a concrete drive and then come over there and come out there. So it's just making it more dangerous through the parking lot there. It's making it more dangerous at this corner down here. So you're really not solving anything.
That intersection down here is going to be a nightmare. You're going to have a left turn lane there underneath where you come under the underpass, so you can have a left turn lane to turn on to 24, the spur, and get back. I don't think there's room enough there for a left turn lane, because when you get heavy traffic in the afternoons, they're coming home from Hanford or whatever it is, and you car after car after car through there, and if you want to make a left-hand turn, you're going to sit there. And you're going to sit there for three or four cars to go by, and there's a truck there, and he wants to make a turn. That thing could turn into a nightmare. For one thing, you can't see down that intersection anyway, down to the north. It's virtually impossible to see that way. And it's just, and the road's not wide enough to put in a left turn lane. So, yeah, you're just going to be stuck.
I don't think it really matters, because I thought you were coming here to kind of ask us what we should all do, but instead, you came here to tell us what you were going to do. And there's a whole different story. story there.
I told you what we
were. But regardless,
I told you what we were,
you're still asking for approval on what you are going to put up there. So what, are you wasting an hour of my time? Seriously, you wasted an hour of everybody's time. I'm sorry you guys throw it out. I really am.
Quite frankly, this is the second meeting I've been to, second workshop I've been to, and the attitude has been the same at both. You guys are set in your ways and will not change. Sure, you've made a few minor changes to your original diagram, but it seems like you guys just don't care about the local businesses and anybody here in town. I mean, it's really sad. Sure, we're all out for safety and we want to save lives, but by saving a few lives at this intersection, how many lives is that going to destroy when you guys put this in and destroy those businesses? How many families are going to be out of work? How many more people are going to have to be welfare because there's no jobs? I mean, it's really sad. It's really sad to see that the state is more interested in destroying businesses instead of trying to come to a mutual agreement and listen to the concerned citizens and everybody come to an agreement and try to help businesses, try to build the businesses.
Mark, you had something to say?
Yes. This is a nice mess we've got ourselves into. Just to set things in perspective, last Saturday, 2 days ago, there was a 3-car injury accident at that intersection. So apparently the lousy economy hasn't made the intersection any safer. This letter from our representatives, Ms. Fagan and Mr. Schmidt, I think is presumptuous. When you put a letter out representing the citizens of Othello, it'd be nice if you came to the council and asked questions and had comments first and then wrote a letter. It's borderline sensationalism. I don't know what your definition of closing an intersection is, but it says it twice in your letter. It's never been mentioned to close that intersection, so I don't know where you're getting your information from, but that is inaccurate. The just as bad as the letter from DOT, as Mr. Kaler addressed, saying that I don't understand it myself, that you can't enforce reduced speed limits and people will do what they want, and if they don't obey laws and you shouldn't have laws, the DOT has lost a lot of credibility with me on that letter. I don't know where people get that opinion, but far as harming business, although they've reduced their credibility with me, they've said that this will actually increase traffic on First. And you'll notice that McDonald's is not here complaining. People find their way into town, go to McDonald's, and find their way out of town. So if there's a little blip here, people will continue to find their way in town and out of town and frequent a business. So I don't think it's all dramatic as the business are saying. And as the gentleman from DOT says, where's some numbers? I mean, right now it is just an intuitive feeling that business is going to tank because if they modify this intersection a little bit. And I don't think there's any data that says that.
Here's something to think about.
Let's hold on a minute. Are you done, Mark?
Just that you say, I don't know how you can discount doing. I was here 5 years ago and I endorsed doing something because I was toned out to all the wrecks and saw the people hurt. So I said, yes, something needs to be done here. And now you practically said, I would love to read the tape about what's a few lives at this intersection compared to the impact on business. And to me, that's a real shallow attitude. So I'm not necessarily agreeing or endorsing this concept, but I think we're getting blindsided by this one side that it's gonna, the whole town's gonna fail, and that a few lives getting killed at this intersection is worth these two businesses making the same profit they are now in the future. So I think we need to take a little broader view on this issue.
For the record, nobody said they were trading money for lives.
He did.
No,
We'll listen to the tape. He says to save a few lives, but what about the lives of the people that lose their jobs? To me, that's a big difference of getting killed in a car wreck and losing your job.
But I don't believe anybody here is endorsing not doing anything. I think something needs to be done safety-wise. I think everybody in here has said that. However, I don't think this is a great plan, because I think 99% of our out-of-town business that comes into town comes on First Street or comes in on 14th, or at 14th Main Street. And you do this, and I think you're effectively shutting off one of our inroads from out of town. And I don't believe they're going to go around and do all that. I think it's too confusing. I think they're going to stop up the road at Royal City, where they can pull off, pull on, and be out of there, and they're going to go right on through. And saying that this is like Killer Corner, I don't think that's true. I think there's a lot of accidents here, but it's nowhere near as bad as Killer Corner, and Killer Corner was out in a more rural area.
And you didn't take into the fact that now Bench Road becomes that jump-off road and just becomes a nightmare also.
That will be a problem.
Yeah, and that's going to happen. I mean, it's reality. Everybody's going to take the easy way out.
Well, I think I'll bring this discussion to an end. I don't think we're going to change anybody's minds here a whole lot, so... we'll have it on the next agenda, so if people want to come back, you'll have an opportunity to share again if you'd like to. You able to make it again, Bob, or are you not going to be here at this next one? I don't know what you're thinking.
I'm sitting down the bottom.
Sure.
The first day, Tuesday of the month.
Monday.
10th.
The 10th.
Next Monday.
Okay. So is that all right, Council, to put on the agenda for next week? And you have a vote, so, you know, that's what this is all about. They'd like to see a vote and see where the Council stands, so that'd be the best way to do it. Bring it back next week. Thank you, everybody, for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fagan and Schmick. Thank you for coming. We appreciate it. Okay, 2.02, well, number 6, discussion. Larry?
How are you going to top that one, Larry?
Be dynamic, Larry.
This shouldn't take more than an hour and a half. Thank you, Mr. Mayor and Council. Nice to see you all again. I just really briefly wanted to update you on a few items with well number 6. First of all, the city had a meeting with Department of Health recently on an unrelated topic, but the question came up on what the status was of Department of Health's potential rule change when it comes to the action level or maximum contaminant level for fluoride in wells. As you may recall, 4 milligrams per liter is the maximum contaminant level right now, where action has to occur if your well has that much fluoride in it. Either shutting the well down, commingling it, treating it, trying to rehab the wells, some action is necessary, as we've seen with well 6. Department of Health indicated that trigger or action level with EPA is right now being looked at between 0.7 milligrams per liter and 1 milligram per liter. They didn't have a timetable of when the proposed change will take place, but it's something that's coming down the pike, we think, fairly soon. Typically, when changes like this are made, or at least in the past when changes like this are made, Health and EPA have given communities a fair warning so they can look at how that affects the rest of their water system and start planning for changes. In the water system plan that we've recently completed, we did look at what the fluoride levels are in all of the wells throughout the community. And excluding well 6, if you look at the average fluoride in the other wells, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, and 8, it'll average between about 1.1 and 3.1 milligrams per liter. So if it's dropped below 1, there's really only one well that's even below that. Well 3 had a range of 0.5 to 3.4 milligrams per liter. So part of the time well 3 would be fine, but the rest of the wells we'd be over that 0.7 to 1 milligram per liter level. It's something we're keeping our eyes on. As soon as we know something definitive, we definitely will let you know. The other issue has to do with the vibration that has occurred in well 6. We did meet with the contractor. The contractor has said they are coming out to take care of or try to eliminate that vibration. They're currently working and coordinating with Public Works for the time that they will come out, shut the well down, and do whatever they need to in there to eliminate that vibration. They have asked a question, though, that if it's determined in their investigation that the vibration was not caused by their construction activities, would the city pay for the repair work? It's something that's not uncommon, particularly in mechanical type work, treatment plants, pump stations, lift stations. We don't see where that could occur in this case. There was no vibration before they took the pump apart and put it back together. There is now. But it's a question they've asked. We approached staff. Eamon said, let's bring it to council to at least see if we can get a consensus or discussion about that topic.
So you're saying they could go to 0.7?
0.7. Somewhere between 0.7 and 1.
That would affect almost every well in Eastern Washington.
Yep.
Not a basin, a well in the basin would survive that. Not one.
So Department of Health, I take it on the other side of the state, their wells have no issue making that.
To be honest, I don't know.
Oh, okay.
But that's something
but
we can definitely look
come
into.
Come up with that figure. Wow.
Sounds like they've been taking the lessons from the Department of Transportation. Hey, yeah, you know, have a meeting and decide whether you're going to sign off on this thing, say yes or no. And if you say no, we're going to do it anyway. And I don't understand the thing with them, and it's kind of the same thing here, with a 45-mile-an-hour speed. Now, I don't see anybody screaming through the intersection up there at the highway at Moses Lake. They got a blinking light there, says 45 miles an hour, and, you know, everybody slows down. So, you know, I think they're blowing smoke through their ear.
Well, I have
anyway, this 0.7 is unreal. I mean, that's, yeah, we just sort of shut down the whole eastern side of the state.
I have a question for Representative Schmick. Puts you on the spot here. Do you guys have any authority over the Department of is it Health? What is it we're talking about here?
State Department of Health and EPA.
DOE, okay. Is it?
Well, I'd kind of like to know where this number came from. On what basis are they having to go to this number? I can certainly ask the Director Select, you know, and ask, I mean, where did this come from? What basis?
EPA, I'm sorry, excuse me.
No, that's okay.
EPA has a federal mandate to increase testing by 37 each year. So each year ratchets up 37 more tests all of us have to take. And this is just another one of those 37.
Wow.
All right,
sir.
Well, if this particular thing happens, it looks to me like we'd have to be bailed out by the state or somebody in order to take care of this. It'll have to go into a filtering system in order to get rid of that or get it down. We could always hold all of that and sell it to people that are trying to have fluoride in their water, but it's always away from here. So that particular part wouldn't work, but it could be filtered out. But I think that the state would have to come in and help us because there's no city like Kansas, there's no city in Eastern Washington that would survive that.
What we've seen in the past is typically EPA and Health will explain the rule as it comes out. There'll be a series of hearings around the state, time for them to take testimony, whether it be at hearings or written, and at that time they explain how they came up with the numbers. And in the past, when they've done things like this that have such a global effect, there have been funding sources available to help pay for it. In today's economy, we don't know if that'll happen or not.
Dan, go ahead.
Ken, you don't understand the realities of state rules. If you've been in education for a while, you'd know that we put in rules that education has to do. You have to do these things, and the state says you have to do them, and if you don't, we're going to cut off your funding, but we're going to give you anyway. So that's what's going to happen here. They're going to say, okay, you have to do it, but we don't have the money to pay you to do it.
Larry, could you go back to the vibration question to the council?
Yeah.
Sure. Oh, sure. The contractor has agreed to come out to site. They're now coordinating with Public Works as far as when they'll come out to shut the pump down, pull the motor, pull the pump if necessary, find out what is causing the vibration and fix it. There was no vibration before they did the work on the well. There's vibration now. They've conjectured a number of different possibilities, from it's been set back together, the motor on the discharge head, maybe it's not quite lined up right, it's not quite plumb, the shaft that holds the motor together to the pump and all of the appurtenances of the equipment in the hole isn't quite lined up right. There's a number of possibilities. The equipment down in the hole, something's come loose from when they were tightening it up. And the only way to find that out is to start into the well and pump, or the motor and pump, and find out what is causing the vibration. They have asked that if during their investigation they find out what the vibration is and how to repair it, if their construction activities did not cause that vibration, would the city then pay for the repairs?
So our question, Mayor, as we discussed at lunch today, is that if staff doesn't want to incur a cost that council hasn't supported yet, so we're just looking for a direction to the mayor to go ahead and go to a point where we know that it is, either is related to the project that they did or it is not. If it's not, then they're going to have to give us an estimate and we come back to you on what it would cost repair. But we just need to tell them something.
So you have an idea what it could cost for them to do some of that before we even start repairing?
If they have to bring a crane in, we were thinking about that because Eamon asked the same question. If they have to bring a crane in to remove the pump that's down a couple hundred feet down hole because they can't get right next to the wellhead because of the pump house, they'd have to bring in special equipment, the crane like they did to pull it. It could be upwards of $10,000 to $15,000. If they just have to take the motor apart and they find something there, that might be a couple thousand dollars. And I wish we had more of a better handle on those costs, but unfortunately, until they get in there and find out what's caused the vibration, it's difficult to say. But again, the vibration wasn't there before the contractor started. It's there now. It's been our contention all along with Public Works, that this is something that was caused by the construction activities. The contractor's just trying to cover all the bases.
So as far as council, do we want to proceed with the realization that we possibly may have a bill out of this?
Can I ask a question here first?
Oh, yeah.
Kind of a question here. What about insurance? Would their insurance cover that, or could we have our insurance cover something if it was our problem or less?
If it did turn out to be something other than construction related, then I would think the insurance would be a likely source. I don't know what the city's insurance policy, how it's set up, but I have seen other communities use that.
How we lucked out with well number four up here.
As you know, we've had several wells problems over the last few years, and our insurance has paid for some of that, the majority of it, actually.
It just seems what they're doing is so out of the norm and normal business. I mean, they came in and there was no problem. They worked on it, and now there's a problem. I mean, it's not like we took it out four-wheeling or did something goofy with it. We just started it back up, and it's vibrating. I don't, to me, they're trying to skirt the issue. I mean, I don't know how, in normal business, you take your car in to get it fixed, and it comes back with it has another problem, they usually fix it.
And Mark, we agree with you that, like I said, there was no vibration before that we're aware of, that nothing as Public Works has mentioned. We feel that it's the contractor's responsibility. Having said that, we recently had a project where, because the owner's operators changed settings on the level of pump drawdown, it was able to suck air, cause cavitation, caused a shaft to break. The contractor came in, the manufacturer came in and fixed it and said, because you changed your set points, we fixed it, here's the bill.
How do we know? Is there somebody there along with them to make sure we see the same thing they do? I guess to make sure that we're represented?
Public Works will be there. We'll have somebody there that's very familiar with pumps and will be watching the contractor do the work.
Okay. Has the contractor agreed that there is a vibration? I mean, they've physically been here and...
Oh, yes.
Well, do you have to put your hand on it, or do you feel it standing there, or...?
You can feel it standing there. Yeah. It's not as bad as the first time it started up, which is the really peculiar thing about it, because once there's vibration in a pump and motor, it only gets worse. It doesn't get better. And the vibration that was felt the day that the mayor was out there was pretty horrendous, we understand. Mm-hmm. But now, when you're out there, you can definitely feel it by putting your hand on the piping. You can go into the chlorination room. You can feel it through the walls. You can't go next door to Burke's Refrigeration and feel it through the walls like you could that Thursday night when it first started to manifest itself. But there definitely is a vibration.
You could hear it out on the street.
Because that well ran most of the weekend, so it's not like it's just sitting there. So apparently it's vibrating itself to death.
So where's the council on this? Do we proceed?
You see, that's the problem, though, Mark, is the more we run it, the more they're going to say we damaged it. We know about the problem. There's a problem. We know what it is. But if it continues and we break shafts or whatever, they're going to say, you should have not ran that because you knew there was a problem, therefore we're going to charge you.
To me, we've made them aware there's a problem. They should be in here fixing it so we can run it. We need to turn the tables on them.
They have agreed to come back. They're just waiting for word from Public Works to when they want them in there.
So the basic issue is, if it's nothing they did and it just started for some reason, we're going to pay for it.
Megan.
Something
we would be doing anyway.
You gotta check it out. That's right.
So the well's no good to us if we don't do something.
We've got to get them in there to fix it, and more than likely it's going to be their fault.
Mm-hmm. Good chance. Larry's feeling.
Yes.
You know, but if it isn't, we got to do something so the well's running.
We would have to make.
We would have to pay. We would have to. They're going to have to bring it back to us, and we'd make the approval to pay and.
It seems like there's a couple pieces of the shaft sitting out. Did it go down a different depth than when we started?
Yeah, it's a little bit shallower. Of course, we filled in the bottom couple hundred feet of the hole anyway.
Right.
But it's a little bit higher elevation than it was. I don't know the exact number. Dan knows that off the top of his head. But it's at a level where there's plenty of water. The first thing that we thought of when it started chattering was, did we start sucking air? All indications are from the pumping rate, how constant it was, from the telemetry readings, that was not a problem. The water samples that were taken right off of the well head were clear. It wasn't cloudy. Cloudy water typically will say you've got air entrained or air movement in there. None of that was seen. So we've talked to pump experts, other manufacturers, that have been doing this all their lives, they're contractors, and it all points towards something just quite, isn't quite in alignment. And the only way to find that is to start taking it apart.
Okay, so I'm hearing from the council is to proceed forward, but we want to know if this is going to get expensive.
Absolutely.
I know there'll be some small bill if it ends up being our fault, just because they had to come in and set up. And, but the minute that changes, we want to hear about it.
Very
so
good.
We can make a decision on what to do. Is that correct, how the council feels?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you,
Larry.
Thanks, Larry.
Okay, 2.03, marijuana grow. Chief Dennigan, we're all wondering about this one.
Well, good evening, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. As you know, you've passed an ordinance to put in place a moratorium against marijuana grow with the controversy that's going on over legalized marijuana. And since the city attorney has said that we need to have discussions and how we're going to regulate that and things, I thought it might be of interest to you to see exactly what it is that we're going to be talking about and regulating as time goes on. As you know, we live in a farm area, and modern agriculture has improved many things. It's improved corn strains, potato strains, beef is beefier, and through the same type of methods, pot is now pottier than it used to be. There are three stages of the growth. They start off as seedlings, just like you would start your regular garden back home. Then they grow into a vegetative state where they're developing leaves and stems, and then they turn to flowering, and that's the third stage where they finalize the actual product that they use to smoke. A good grow will actually have a three-room grow where they have a room of starters, they have a room of vegetative, and then they have a room designed for developing the final product. If they do this, a good grower can crop or have a harvest every 90 days. And the good grows are indoor, not outdoor. Currently, in the state of Washington, the price per ounce for marijuana, good marijuana, is $277. That equates to about $4,432 per pound. And when I say good marijuana, what I'm talking about is Sensimilia. Sensimilia just means without seed, and that's the Spanish word for it. Because in a grow, what the grower tries to do is he eliminates all male plants, so there is no pollination of the female plants, which causes the female to want to grow bigger with her buds and get stickier with the resins that normally would catch the pollination to pollinate the plant. Back in the 60s and 70s, when I grew up, when marijuana was popular, we called it ditchweed. It had an average THC level of maybe 3 or 4%. Today, based on good agricultural practices and what they know how to do now, it's really a science. The University of Mississippi tests marijuana THC contents from submissions all over the United States. They have tested marijuana to date as high as 37% THC, which is the intoxicant that's smoked and inhaled. So what I thought, I have a short video clip I got off YouTube. It's a how-to video. It will show you how to set up a grow, some of the equipment that's used, and what we'll be able to see by the end of what we're watching is how much marijuana actually can be generated out of a very small space. Go ahead, Stan.
Attic in a normal terraced house. This room is about 6 meters square, of which we use around 3 square meters for the plants. We start by cleaning the empty room. To prevent bacteria and fungus, we use a good disinfectant. We use plenty of water and ensure we don't miss a single spot. Great care is one of the main provisos for growing cannabis. Let the room dry thoroughly. In the meantime, we have plenty of time to purchase the materials needed. We buy these in a grow shop. For example, here in Hydro Hobby in Arnhem. We don't want neighbors wondering what's going on, so we try to eliminate all risks. From the outside, the situation stays as it was. A normal attic or bedroom. In the room itself, we cover the fixed window with fireboard. To make the room airtight and prevent light being seen from the outside, we glue the fireboard to the window frame with silicone glue and screw it down. For the casement window, a special fireboard construction is made. Here, a ceiling ring is fixed to attach the air outlet hose at a later stage. We screw the window tight so that it remains ajar. Around the window frame, we fix loudspeaker cloth. In this way, we block the view to the inside while keeping the air outlet free. Screwing it to the window, we also apply silicone glue. To avoid leakage, we create a shallow basin to put the plants in. On the floor, we create an approximately 30 centimeter high rim. Polystyrene plates are laid on the bottom to avoid the plants coming into contact with the colder ground. After this, we cover the basin with PVC foil. Of course, the foil is only stapled to the top of the rim. The next step is to cover the walls and ceiling with PVC foil. To mask the temperature difference, we apply anti-detection foil to the ceiling. The walls are covered with a black and white foil. The white side of this foil reflects the light, which increases the effect of the lamps. The black side is fixed to the wall and prevents fungus growth. All joints are sealed with so-called duct tape. This ensures that the room is airtight and no light can spill out, while vermin and bacteria have no chance of getting in. To fit out the growing room, we first suspend lamps. This is the most logical step, because the lamps have to be positioned right over the plants. We use 3 600-watt Industria medium lamps for our plants. The Industria assimilation lamp has a safety trademark. As the lamps weigh approximately 10 kilos each, the suspension system has to be sufficiently robust. These lamps are water resistant and the chance of short circuiting or fire is minimal. The reflector of the Industria illuminates an area of 1.2 to 1.4 meters. The lamps are hooked on chains so they can be adjusted in height. the three lamps use 1800 watts per hour. To avoid overloading the fuses, we limit the number of equipment to one electrical circuit. We have connected the two outer lamps on the outside, so they will be lit simultaneously. One of the most important elements for home growing is good air circulation. The plants must breathe. The evaporated moisture has to be dispensed with, and the heat of the lamps must be dispersed. Separate equipment is used for a supply of fresh air and for the used air outlet. Moreover, the air that is ventilated has to be thoroughly filtered. We don't want bad odors escaping the room. Because the air pump is located inside an insulated box, it can easily be hooked onto the ceiling. The boxes are hooked to rubber rings, thereby avoiding vibration and noise pollution. The carbon coal filter is connected to the air exhaust. We have chosen a CAN 366 carbon coal filter. CAN carbon coal filters have a large surface area, which allows a lot of air to pass through. Moreover, the air filtering carbon grains are thoroughly vibrated, which increases the density. These qualities guarantee a long working life for the filter. The capacity of the carbon filter and the air outlet pump must be matched. The carbon coal filter must have enough capacity to filter the whole room. We also fix a sound muffler between the external opening and the exhaust air pump. The muffler will filter the sound of the ventilating air from the pump. For the same reason, we have chosen insulated air hoses. To achieve optimal air circulation, the air supply enters at ground floor level, while the air outlet is placed at the top. We split the hoses to spread the air supply at ground level. By pointing the outlets of the two hoses towards the floor, the fresh air will spread via the floor and the underside of the plants. We connect the fresh air supply to a room within the house. Indoors, humidity and temperature are more constant here than outdoors. To avoid odor pollution indoors, the capacity of the air exhaust has to exceed the capacity of the air inlet. Of course, the growing room has to be fitted out with sockets and other special equipment. For our safety and to prevent short circuits, we use sockets with earth connections. We install an electronic climate control unit on a suitable place in the wall. A 150-liter water barrel is placed in a corner of the room. This barrel is immediately filled with 30 liters of fresh water. We then place the following equipment in the barrel: a water pump connected to a garden hose with a spray nozzle, and a circulation pump that will provide a good mix of water and nutrients, and a heating element to keep the water temperature constantly at 23 degrees Celsius. Right, the growing room is as good as fitted out. We grow the plants in potting compost. For this, we use wide pots with a capacity of 16 liters. The holes in the bottom of the pot have more than one function. Superfluous water can be drained off, but also the...
Okay, so that gives you the kind of the idea of what, how big a grow room has to be and how sophisticated it can get. This guy uses a lot of good filters to keep his neighbors from being able to smell it. Some people don't, and when we do knock and talks, that's what we use a lot of is our noses, because we can smell it, and that's the way to get in, or at least get a probable cause to have a search warrant issue. So now he's done all that, he's grown some plants. Now this next video is way short, but it will show you what the plants look like, what the product is. Go ahead.
cases for bugs, black spots, and other abnormalities. The plants are in perfect health. The growth blooms richly, and some tiny hairs in the tops start to turn slightly brown. We give the plant as much water and nutrients as during the two previous weeks. We lower the air humidity further by pumping out more air. Some tops have gained so much weight, they begin to bend. We avoid this by shoring the plants up with bamboo sticks. The tops are now very sensitive for bud rot, a kind of mold in the tops. Therefore, the air humidity must not be higher than 50% during this stage. We carefully clean the barrel once more, so no nutrients will be left behind. The plants will only be watered with fresh water, so they will be given no more nutrients. The tops will extract the last nutrients from the leaves and the soil. The hair on the tops becomes browner every day, and some leaves begin to wither. We remove these leaves and water the plants for the last time. During the last few days, they will be given nothing. The plants are now clearly in the end phase. The tops feel hard and compact, and 70 to 80% of the hair is brown. Time to harvest. The lamps have done their job, so we unplug them from the timer switches. The air supply and air exhaust is kept working, but the electronic climate controller is set to a temperature of 18 degrees Celsius. The plants are cut at the bottom of the stem. First, we remove all the large leaves by hand. Then we cut all the very small leaves around the tops. This is a laborious job, but practice makes perfect. Using the aardvark is faster than cutting with scissors. This device can be connected to any vacuum cleaner. The aardvark is a cutting machine that avoids the need to remove the large leaves. No more cramped fingers using this machine. Even the smallest tops are cut away without any problem. When all plants are cut, we tie a few ropes across the room. Then we hang the plants upside down on these ropes. To minimize the chance of mold, the tops must not come into contact with each other. The required humidity in the room, while drying, is around 40%, at a temperature of 18 degrees Celsius. The plants now need to dry for 10 to 12 days in the dark. If this drying process is shortened, the chlorophyll will not completely disappear. During the drying process, we check the tops on a regular basis for bud rot. The leaves, which were at first green, have turned gray in the meantime. This means the chlorophyll has been completely broken down. When the stem tops have become crispy, we cut away every top. The cropped tops are put in airtight bags, which we store in a dry and dark place. and after all the weeks of attention and care, the harvest is now ready for consumption.
He probably had 3, maybe 4 pounds of marijuana there, so that would have been one crop. And he probably spent $3,500 for the equipment to set up that grow. And that was a typical dirt grow. They also have hydroponic grows, which are all of the plants are grown in a water solution. There is no dirt, so those are very clean. They changed it from white vinyl to aluminum now. It's called Mylar. That's what they'll put up on the walls to reflect the lights. And usually a grower is very proud of their product, and they're very happy to talk about how they grow, because it's almost like an art, and so good ones are really good and bad ones are bad. He talked a lot about mold on the buds. If you don't do things just right, you overload with humidity or whatever, you get mold, and then you ruined all your marijuana. So that's a grow. That's about what the product looks like. There are all kinds of varieties out there. I think he said that they were going to use K2. I don't know what that is, but there's all kinds of special names for it out there. You'll find grows in very unique places. You'll find them behind hidden doors. Probably the most unique one that I've ever been in was a grow that was, it was a grow that belonged to the Hells Angels out of Fairbanks. It was out in the middle of a gold mining field in Tok, Alaska, and we went in and did that one. It was 45 degrees below zero outside. This was an underground grow. It ran off generator, so it was a very labor-intensive grow. But once you got into the grow itself, the door was only about that big. You had to be almost a contortionist to get in, and then you drop down inside. The temperature was over 80 degrees underground in Alaska at 45 below, because just from the heat from the lamps. So these lights get very hot. Anyway, that's a marijuana grow. Any questions?
We used to hear that sometimes people were alerted to grows because their electricity bill spiked.
That's correct. Yeah. Once upon a time, and I don't know, I haven't checked with our utility companies down here, but once upon a time that information was freely given, but then there's been a lot of restrictions placed on that. Mm-hmm. So you have to actually have information to get a search warrant to get the utility records now. People. But when he set those three lamps up, he said those were 600 watt lamps apiece, so he was running 1800 watts per hour. And you're doing that basically 24 hours a day. There's a break in there, but it's not very much. Because the whole idea is to trick the plant. As long as the plant thinks it's summer and it's time to grow, it's going to grow. And then they actually shut it off when they're ready to shut it off. But that's one way to do it. The other way is smell. You notice that he went into another room inside the house to draw fresh air in to put into the room, and then it was filled in and put out that window that he had jimmied up to so that it would always be open. So the bad air goes out and the fresh air comes in, and when it goes out the window, it's going to smell. If you've ever smelled fresh marijuana, it's very distinctive. I personally like the smell of fresh marijuana. It has to be fresh. I don't like the smell of burnt stuff. But in a plant, it's unique. And so that odor floats, and the neighbors will pick up on it, and so the cops will go over there like that. And if you get a whiff of it, that's good enough to get you in the door with a search warrant.
Watching papers, I've noticed there's many, many cities going with the 6-month moratorium right now. You know, and I couldn't think of a better night to have our representatives here, because I think this is an issue we're going to be coming back to you to help us with, because I don't think it should be solely up to the cities to set up ordinances on how to grow marijuana.
Well, I think that what police and sheriffs would like is a distinct line instead of all this gray area. That seems to be the request. Decide whether it's legal or not, and whether make it defined.
because the way the law is written right now with community gardens and things like that, it sounds nice, community garden. You've seen what it is. It's a commercial operation. There's nothing community about it. It's money making. So it's either, it is either legal or illegal, or it's not. And it's going to be very hard to find all those loopholes and try to really hold anybody accountable for doing it, because they can be selling to people who are already have the doctor's authorization to smoke it. But, you know, when you grow that much marijuana in that small of a space, if you open that up and really do something, but what was the plant limit? 45 or something?
Yeah.
That's a heck of a lot of marijuana. That's going to support more than six people. So you're going to sell it. And you're going to want to sit on it. So, very interesting situation we're in.
Well, the governor vetoed all of the bills except for the community gardens. And, but there are legislators who will come back again and try again. But as long as it's a federal offense, I mean, you're not going to get law enforcement. And the governor understood that. But most towns that I've been reading about, especially in Eastern Washington, are not approving community gardens. Pullman just passed them. And
well,
there was an arrest in Colfax, you know, of an individual who was from it.
We've passed a moratorium to prohibit it for the 6 months to give everybody a chance to discuss it and debate it and find out more legalities and what the state's going to use. But the feds, it is against the federal law, but the feds aren't going to come in and do these grows of this size. When I was working narcotics in Alaska, if we didn't have 750 plants to 2,000 plant co-ops, the feds weren't even interested in doing a case on it. So we would do the case. It was criminal. It would just be state. But the feds wouldn't help us with it, and they wouldn't take it as a federal charge and move it into an OSIDEP case or anything, because it just wasn't. These things are just too small for them to mess with. They don't have the resources.
Thank you, Chief.
You bet. If there's any other questions, feel free to stop by and ask. If I don't know, I'll find out.
Hey, we have any committee reports? Everybody okay? We've got lots of that coming forward. Unfinished business. New business. Okay, mayor's announcements. Adams County Fire District number 5 is having their second biannual meeting on Tuesday, October 11th at 7 p.m. This meeting will be held at the fire station during their regular commissioner meeting. So City Fire Council is Mark Spohr, Mark Snyder, and Dan Deaver. Everybody on board? Good. The first three budget committee meetings will convene this week as followed. Contracts is Wednesday at 5, room 3 at noon. That's Johnson, Kaler, and Deaver. Everybody on for that? Okay. Street Fund is Thursday, October 6th, room 3 at noon. Council members Garcia, Snyder, and Darrow. Looks like everybody's getting meals out of this deal. That's a pretty good deal. That's how we get you there. Solid Waste is Friday, October 7th, room 3 at noon. Council members Spohr, Snyder, and Kaler. Okay. Other than that, thank you everybody for coming. This meeting is adjourned.